Welcome to But Her Lyrics, the show where we delve into the political lyrics of songs I like, songs I wrote, or topics that I think should be a song. I'm Shauna Potter, singer and lyricist for War on Women, and your host. This episode is about a topic that could be a song, but I think it might be years before anyone that isn't a right-wing asshole takes a shot at it. Today, I'm talking to Clementine and Jay, hosts of the podcast Fucking Cancelled, which aims to challenge the efficacy of cancel culture in order to, quote, build an effective and organized left based in solidarity. You're going to hear them talk about cancel culture's effects on victims of sexual violence and other forms of harm, as well as the effects on those accused of that violence and those close to both parties. So, huge trigger warning for sexual violence, child abuse, and addiction, etc. So get ready to use one of those grounding techniques we talked about in the last But Her Lyrics episode with Sky Daddy, right? Get your frozen orange out. But please, if you can, keep an open mind. I know people have really strong feelings about cancel culture, myself included, but I promise this is not the same chat you'd have with your racist uncle or your MAGA grandma. That is not the conversation we're having today. And to be clear, what I care about most is finding and supporting and participating in practices that help prevent sexual violence or help the victims of it in their journey to healing and justice. And I'm a fan of science, right? So if it turns out that something we have held as true and good could be improved or is actually harmful, well, I want to hear about it. And sometimes that means listening to ideas that feel at odds with what is currently the norm. I am not tied to any specific way we get there. I just want to live in a less violent world. And I'm certainly not so egotistical to think we've figured everything out perfectly already. Just like I'm not trusting enough of our government to believe they're going to figure it out for us. We can do this, right? We keep us safe. But we have to have good faith conversations, even if they're hard, and feel safe enough to do so in order to find those answers we're looking for and to keep improving. But maybe I'm not giving you enough credit. Maybe this long exposition isn't necessary. I think I'm over-explaining out of fear. Fear that my intentions will be willfully misunderstood or things we say will be taken out of context and used against us. We talk about that fear in this interview, and I can't wait for you to hear it. But if this is your first time listening to But Her Lyrics, wild choice, wild place to start. You might want to go back and listen to my interviews with survivors, sexual assault prevention activists, people involved in direct victim services, even the writers of songs about revenge against their abusers. I'll put all the links to the relevant episodes in the show notes so you can find them easily. Or, you know, don't. You do you.
Patreon!
Before we get into it, I want to shout out our official sponsors, First Defense Krav Maga and Pupcakes and Pastries, who just sent Rosie an amazing array of little doggy cupcakes, like birthday cupcakes. They're so sweet. They're so cool. So anyway, check them out. First Defense Krav Maga, Pupcakes and Pastries. Links in the show notes. Check them out. And big thanks to my recruits, Melissa and Ronnie. Ronnie has a cool trans-affirming hair salon in Seattle. Look up Navarro Hair Design. And to my meatheads, Stefan, Zachary, Bob, Byron, Russell, and Isaias, hello. And Hunters, Mike, Andrus, Lydia, Tim, Bessie, Zachary, Kevin, Lauren. This podcast would not exist without you. You know that. And your support helps me do all my other work, including the band. So thank you. And if you want a shout out, join my Patreon, where you'll also get access to behind the scenes stuff, bonus content, and you can request random shit from me. I'm open-minded, so just message me. We'll see if we can work it out. So cancel culture is on my mind because I see call outs and things related to them play out online a lot, obviously, but what I don't see is what comes after. And I sense a lot of fear around being called out, but I don't see a lot of healing. or justice. And frankly, it just feels difficult to have a healthy, nuanced conversation about all of it. So I hope that's what we achieved in this episode. If you want to hear my specific and sometimes much darker thoughts around it, join my Patreon, but you'll probably get more out of listening to this interview instead. Interview time! Clementine and Jay, thank you so much for joining me on But Her Lyrics. Please introduce yourself to everyone.
Okay. Hi, I'm Clementine Morgan, and I am a writer, and I have a podcast with Jay called Fucking Canceled, and I write a lot about, originally I wrote a lot about like relationships, sexuality, and trauma recovery were sort of like the main themes that my work has been organized around over the many years that I've been writing. And then in the past several years, I have become known for my work on cancel culture, which is also the focus of the podcast that Jay and I have.
Yeah, my name's Jay. I am also a writer, an artist, been a musician, and I have a background in anthropology. Did my master's on far right studies, which is studying the far right, not studying well being far right.
I wondered.
To be clear. And I have spent the last several years working in homeless shelters as an intervention worker. I'm also one half of Fucking Canceled.
So let's start with the basics. What is cancel culture to you?
Cancel culture exists across the political spectrum, but the focus that we have is cancel culture in like lefty, liberal, social justice type spaces. And the reason we focus on that is because we are inside those spaces. We are leftists. We're queer people. We are inside the social justice world. And so our focus is on cancel culture in that world, but cancel culture also exists in a different form on the right and in other places, but that's not our focus. And so cancel culture is basically when a person has been accused of something, there is a campaign in order to deny that person's right to empathy and to human belonging. And so that person becomes marked as a target, as someone who is now seen as bad. Often this is framed as calls for accountability, but in reality, accountability is like forever receding into the distance, and it's actually seems to be impossible for people to be accountable in a way that stops the cancellation, or allows them to continue to have a life. When a person is canceled, every single person in their life, from their friends, their partner, to people who follow them on social media or who are fans of their work, also receive social pressure to denounce and abandon the target. Importantly, there is absolutely no method through which accusations are interrogated to find out if they are true. And so there's no process to actually find out if the accusations make any sense, are based in reality, or are justifying this level of response. And so I understand cancel culture as literally making it a social crime to be friends with someone, care about them, or have empathy for them. And so this works to socially isolate people in a major way, where they lose friends, relationships. Also, they can lose their job, they can lose job opportunities, and they can be banned from spaces. And it also often, but not always, has a large social media component in which accusations are being spread across the internet in a sort of broken telephone style, where people are repeating things and the accusations are like changing and no one is fact checking, because how could they? Because many of the people who are involving themselves in this cancellation actually don't know the people involved and don't actually know what happened or if anything happened. And there's also a very like vague use of language where people are conflating things, right? So we use the word abuse very vaguely. We don't actually say what it is that we mean when we're saying that someone is abusive. Similarly, for other types of cancellations where someone is accused of being racist or accused of being transphobic or other things like that, those types of accusations are often passed around without any actual content about what it is that they're being accused of that makes them an abuser, a racist, or transphobic, just as examples, right? So we aren't actually given the facts, so people can't really assess whether or not this accusation makes any sense. And it's also, under the logic of cancel culture, considered a crime to ask questions about accusations, because the refrain "believe survivors" is always used to say that we can never ever ask or question whether or not accusations make sense or are true. And so this has a huge impact on people's lives. And a really important thing to point out is that when talking about cancel culture, what often happens is that people always want to focus on celebrities. People always want to focus on famous rich people, and they want to talk about that and say, well, no one's really canceled because these people are super rich and they still continue to have careers.
I'm thinking of Dave Chappelle, you know, being quote unquote canceled for being transphobic, but he keeps getting Netflix specials and getting paid for them.
Yes. And so the thing is that everybody wants to focus on celebrities, but the vast, vast, vast majority of people who are canceled are not celebrities. The vast, vast majority of people who are canceled are just regular people who neither you nor I have actually heard of. They are just regular people who, like, maybe they have a band, like a local band, or maybe they run a vegan bakery, or maybe they, you know, in some kind of way were involved in like organizing in their city or something like that, but they're not famous and they're definitely not rich. They don't have PR people. They don't have lawyers. And so they are not in the same position to actually protect themselves from the total social and material annihilation that cancel culture can unleash upon their lives. Do you want to add to that?
No, that's pretty thorough.
That was pretty thorough.
Not everyone agrees with y'all's point of view, right? I asked folks on my socials to submit questions for this episode. And one of the common ones was, why don't we just call it consequence culture? Because isn't that all it is?
I mean, that sounds like something a cop would say.
Okay.
First of all, as I said, many of the accusations are false and overstated. So how can there be consequences for something that you didn't actually do, right? And so even in the criminal justice system, for all its problems, there is still such a thing as a trial and the right to defend yourself, right? And so people are allowed to defend themselves. There's the idea that you are innocent and until proven guilty, and that you have the right to like a lawyer, and you have the right to state your side of things, and you have the right to be defended.
You have the right to know who your accuser is and also what the charges are against you as well. Mm.
Exactly. And so in cancel culture, you know, who is deciding? Who is deciding what the consequences are? And who are you to enforce consequences upon someone who is saying that they did not do what they were accused of, or that what they are accused of is not actually, they haven't actually done anything wrong, right?
I think that people have this notion that there are these sort of like, these organizations that must be in charge of all of this in some way. You know, there must be sort of like groups or panels or, you know, some kind of like people getting together to go over the accusations and make sure that they're accurate and you know, coming up with reasonable consequences for people, you know, and then relaying those to the person who is being accused or whatever. But in reality, the whole process is like this kind of like mob fueled spectacle, like that no one's in charge, like almost always, you know, and there is, you know, there are no checks and balances of any kind because it's not institutional in any way, right? Mostly it's just happening as this sort of diffuse process on social media that nobody's in charge of, nobody's keeping track of. And so the idea that there could be just sort of these like reasonable consequences for someone is really gesturing at a form of organization that doesn't exist, you know, and people maybe like wish that it did or something, but in almost all cases that we've seen, there's no such thing.
And going directly to consequences without first determining what happened and whether or not those consequences are appropriate is literally like going to sentencing without having a trial. Because how can you enforce consequences on someone when there's multiple different understandings of what happened, when there's disagreement about what happened, and when there hasn't actually been any kind of process to figure out if those consequences are relevant or make sense? And, you know, for all of this talk of accountability, who is holding the cancelers accountable? Who is checking to make sure that the use of this massive power, this massive social power to control people's lives, to enforce consequences on them, that is actually being used in a responsible and just way? And the reality is nobody's holding the cancelers accountable. And so they can obviously use this form of power in all sorts of irresponsible ways.
I can imagine that some of my listeners' hackles are going up hearing some of this stuff. Do you mind, you know, telling us a little bit about in the most polite way. Like, what's your expertise? Like, what are like, I know someone's listening going, what gives you the right to think this way? But what schools of thought inform this work?
Well, first, I think that we both are of the opinion that anyone can think any way that they want, you know?
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, I think that our sort of intellectual backgrounds, if you want to say, that contribute to this is we both have a long history in the 12 steps. Both of us have been in 12-step, environments for like a decade. And it contributed hugely to the way that we think about what it means to actually sort of like be accountable, with quotation marks around it. How do people get better? You know, if people have like hurt others in their lives and have done things that they regret, like what is the best way to sort of bring them back to a place where they're no longer doing those things, to a place where they can be responsible? And so we have, you know, some ideas about that because we've seen it work over and over and over again in situations that often are much more sort of dire than the ones that people are mad about in social justice world. Uh-huh. You know? And so we know that people can change their ways and can, you know, become the kinds of people that they would like to be. And it happens through resourcing people and giving them community instead of taking it away. So that's like one major part of the way that we think.
So, I mean, I'm a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. I am a survivor of domestic violence. My entire life has been shaped through complex trauma and the amount of physical and sexual violence that I have experienced in my life. So I really like to say that because I really don't appreciate the like way that people weaponize the identity of survivor or flatten different survivors' perspectives on all of this, or assume that the only reason somebody could take the stance that I'm taking is because they don't understand or they don't care about survivors. It's actually the exact opposite. Like, I care about survivors more than I care about anything else because that has been the entire, you know, shaping of my life. I have, you know, a lot of recovery now, but complex PTSD fully shaped the trajectory of my life. And so my understanding of all of this is deeply, deeply rooted in the experience of being a survivor. And one controversial opinion that I have is that I actually believe that cancel culture appropriates from survivors language that is very serious and that was initially like put forth by feminists to address very serious things like domestic violence and child sexual abuse. And then they use this language to basically have petty drama and to silence people who disagree with them, or to, you know, make sure that like people that they don't like can't enter into spaces. And there's a lot of bad faith use of this lineage of work to actually protect and empower survivors. So that's like a big part of it. Also, my understanding of trauma, you know, that's me acknowledging that a lot of people do this in bad faith and maliciously. But at the other side is that my understanding of trauma, both through my own experience of it and the fact that I, you know, am basically like an amateur scholar of trauma who has read every single book about trauma that exists in order to understand my own experience. Trauma is literally a disability under which you have emotional and nervous system reactions appropriate to the past in the present. Right? So survivors of child abuse, survivors of, you know, formative experiences of trauma, developmental trauma, are very likely in the future to feel that they are being abused when they are not. Not because they're being malicious, not because they're being intentionally dishonest, but because due to their past trauma, they can feel extremely overwhelming emotions and also feel a lack of agency when they do in fact have agency in the present. And so I also believe that there can be a genre of cancellations in which people are making false accusations or overstated accusations, but they're not being intentionally dishonest. They actually believe that they have less power than they do, and they actually believe that something was abusive when it wasn't, because the emotional and nervous system reactions that they're having are coming from abuse, but they're coming from earlier abuse. And so I have had that experience. And I think that to truly support survivors, especially survivors of developmental trauma, it is not enough to say, believe survivors and leave it at that. Survivors deserve friends and community who can help them do the important work of discernment, which is to actually look at what has happened, the details of what has happened. Not just the emotional response of the person, but the details of the actual actions, and to help them to understand whether or not what has happened is abuse or whether or not it is an unhappy relationship, conflict, a relationship that's not meeting their needs. And due to their past trauma, they have less understanding of their own agency and their own ability to leave a situation that isn't meeting their needs, you know? And so I think that cancel culture is actually really bad for survivors. It is really trauma illiterate, actually, and doesn't provide us with the necessary tools to discern between different kinds of situations and then use appropriate responses.
Also, finally, I think a socialist, materialist view of the world, which is one that Clementine and I share, calls on us to look for more like structural solutions to the problems that people are facing, you know? And I think that cancel culture is very much part of a hyper-focus on the individual, as well as a hyper-focus on identity, which is like a whole other aspect of it. But it allows people to imagine that they can solve like very big intractable problems by picking a person who has like, you know, caused some kind of problem and punishing them, right?
Right.
As though that is going to change like the larger structure that is enabling these problems in the first place. And that's like an understandable kind of natural human inclination. But I think that if we're serious about wanting to, you know, like end like violence against women, for example, you know, we need to be really like steadfastly looking at the structural elements that allow it to flourish, the things that make women unsafe, you know, the things that make it so that they can't leave partners that are violent, like that kind of thing, you know. And we need to be pushing as much as we can to change those on a much larger level than just picking like some fucking drummer and destroying his life, you know.
Oh man.
I'm sorry to just go on and on, but I feel like I have just a couple other things to add to this. I also want to say that like this division between perpetrator and survivor also really upsets me, because survivors of child abuse, which honestly, my allegiance and my solidarity is first and foremost with child abuse survivors, right? And the severe like developmental trauma that we develop as a result. Many survivors of child abuse go on to have extremely chaotic lives full of like, you know, mental illness, incarceration, and addiction. And so many people who had very severely traumatic childhoods go on to do things that are abusive. And so this like false binary between like an abuser and a survivor does not allow us to actually see and understand that many of the people who are being quite abusive are survivors of child abuse and like very serious things that have happened to them. And they also deserve compassion and resources and an understanding of their experience as a survivor. It bothers me that we don't offer that compassion. And then one last thing is that, you know, for as much as everyone's like, this is about safety and this is about keeping people safe, I really wonder when people say things like that, I'm like, have you met super violent, abusive guys? Because the reality is, like, I'm a survivor of domestic violence, very serious domestic violence. And the reality is that if I were to make a website about my ex and slander him on the internet, or not even slander in this case, because it's true, but like talk shit on the internet,
yeah,
like talk shit, say what he did, make websites demanding that he's canceled, he would be so angry that he would attack me. He would stalk me and attack me, right? So like, it's just like very like unrealistic in situations of like severe violence and like physical and sexual violence, especially domestic violence, that this would even be a realistically like helpful tool for survivors. Because when you do things like that, abusers get angry and they tend to take that anger out on the target of their rage, which is their partner or their ex-partner, right? So I just also think like pragmatically, it's not a very useful tool, because it's like, if these people were as scary as you're saying that they are with these cancellation campaigns, they would probably lash out violently in response to being canceled like this, right? So I just don't see it as a realistic tool.
Do you think that there are circumstances where a public call out or cancellation attempt is warranted?
Like, it's sort of like, what are we trying to achieve with it? Right? Mm-hmm. That's the question. And what are we trying to achieve? And is it going to achieve that? People will say, for example, that it's about warning people. And so we need to make sure that people know so that this person isn't coming around so that it can, so that we can be safe. Right? But the reality is that unless you kill someone, which you shouldn't do, or you lock them into solitary confinement, which is also wrong, that person is going to continue to be around other human beings, right? So even if we constantly try to drive this person out of our community for safety reasons, where are they going to go? They're going to go somewhere else. And wherever they go, there's going to be other people. And so I don't think that that's like a very effective way to end violence, to just make sure that, you know, we're warning everybody and we're not letting this person into spaces, because eventually they're going to go somewhere else and they're going to find another way to be in spaces because they are a human being. That's what human beings do. Secondly, I think it creates a false idea about safety, because we're like, oh, we know who the abusers are. It's this guy, this guy, and this guy. Mm-hmm. So as long as those guys aren't in the space, we don't have to worry. It's a safer space now. But the reality is that there's many other people who are abusive in the space who have not yet been canceled. And so I think our energy would be better served in actually trying to address, one, why are people being abusive and how can we help them to not be abusive? And two, how can we help people to actually build spaces that are more literate to understanding when violence is going on and how we can best protect ourselves and each other, right? And like, one of the things that I've been doing since I was a teenager is intervening on domestic violence situations that are unfolding in public. And I'm extremely good at it. I know how to de-escalate. I'm 5'1" and I have de-escalated many violent situations successfully without anybody getting hurt. And that's something that I'm good at and that I know how to do. But do all of these people who love making websites about other people and canceling people know how to do that? Because I feel like that type of skill, if we actually spent our time building that skill set, would be far more effective in ending violence than canceling people.
For someone like me who cares about violence prevention and supporting victims of gender-based violence throughout their journey of healing, where does your analysis of cancel culture fit into that? I think you're already touching on that, but like, what do we do as the friends or community of victims? What do we do?
Well, like, weirdly, you know, one thing about cancel culture, like, especially when it's a cancellation that's revolving around some kind of accusation of like abuse or something like that, weirdly, it focuses on the accused rather than the person who is like supposed to have been harmed, you know? And I think that something that we definitely could do is spend more time and more energy taking care of people who have gone through something really like painful and potentially like dangerous, you know, and potentially traumatizing. And like, I don't see very much of that, honestly. Mm. You know, I think I see a lot of people pouring a lot of energy into like punishing strangers on the internet, you know. But it's like, if you suspect that your friend is like living through a dangerous relationship, you know, like, you really should be trying to find effective and safe ways to intervene on that, help that person in concrete ways, you know, learn the necessary skills too, because it's not necessarily as straightforward as people might think. Mm-hmm. If you know that your friend has, just recently exited a relationship like that, they're going to need a lot of support too. Potentially they might need to be made physically safe as well, like moved like out of the place they're living, like things like this, you know, depending on what kind of things that they've been living through. And like, I think that we could be putting far more energy towards actually directly supporting people who are living through things like that. And it would be a lot better for everyone involved if we were putting our energy towards that.
Yeah. So like, depending on, as Jay is saying, depending on where the survivor is on the journey, the type of support that is necessary changes, right? And in every stage of that, I actually think that cancel culture is bad for survivors. Mm-hmm. But in the first stage, when a person is in a domestic violence relationship, actually the worst thing that you could do is tell them that their partner is a piece of shit. Because what that does is it drives them closer to the abuser, because they are still wrapped up in that dynamic. And if a person is starting to be honest with you that there's some type of violence or abuse going on in their relationship, the best thing that you can do is you do point out that the behavior is wrong without dehumanizing or like, you know, talking like that person is a piece of shit, because the person, the survivor, loves that person.
Right.
So if you say that person is garbage, like you shouldn't be with them, what they're going to do is stop telling you what's going on. They're going to isolate themselves from you because they're not ready yet. Right. And so the actual nuances of supporting a survivor inside an abusive relationship is to highlight their own agency, right? Don't tell them what to do, because the fact is that they're already being told what to do constantly. They need to be in their own power. Hmm. And, you know, you do point out that the behavior is concerning and that you are worried, you know, and you can be honest about that, because you're like, I love you, and this behavior is worrying me, you know, you can be honest about that, but you need to let that person make their own decisions. And you need to allow for the complexity of that person's actual experience, which is that they love the person who's abusing them. And if you deny them that, then they are going to stop talking to you. And so, you know, one of the best things that you can do for a survivor who's in an actively abusive relationship is give them a key to your apartment and tell them that they can use it anytime that they need it. And that you are here to listen and to be supportive, but also that you're going to center their own agency in that process, you know?
There's a flip side to this too, which is something that Clementine was sort of mentioning earlier, which is that part of being a responsible friend is also being able to discern whether or not, you know, the person in question really is being abused, you know, because it is possible that they might believe that they are, or they might say that they are, without that necessarily being accurate, you know. And, you know, sometimes people might, you know, sort of make up stories for whatever various reasons, but also sometimes, and what Clementine was saying earlier, I think this is really important, people might, you know, really feel like what they're going through is most accurately called abuse. But, you know, when you get down to like the facts of what's actually happening, it might not be. Like, it might be conflict that they're experiencing in a really emotional way. It might be, I mean, there's, you know, a lot of different reasons why somebody might feel so overwhelmed that they feel like abuse is the best way to describe it. But if it isn't, if that's not really what's going on, like, and this is like a scary thing to do, but it might be necessary to talk to that person about that and see if you can help them come to a, you know, a more accurate understanding, and one which honestly like empowers them more, right?
Yeah.
And centers their own agency.
Yeah. Clementine, in the past, you have written about how you falsely accused your ex of abuse. Mm-hmm. And could you speak about that? And then also speak about like, how did you get out of thinking that way? How did you get out of having that false body response?
You know, just to give a little background to the story, like, as I've said, I have had an insanely fucked up life, right? And so I'm a survivor, and I have gone through childhood sexual abuse, years of alcoholism where I was like assaulted all the time by all sorts of people, and then very severe domestic violence that went through the courts, right? Mm. So I have had a crazy life. When I got sober when I was 25 and I started to have a less crazy life and I started to not experience violence all the time, I was still riddled with CPTSD in such an insane way, right? Like, my CPTSD was so debilitating that I really did not have like the sense of empowerment and agency. And I was constantly flooded with nervous system responses that were extremely overwhelming, right? So my first serious relationship in sobriety was with a person who was also sober, and we were together for 3 years. That relationship, upon retrospect, you know, now many years later, was a classic anxious avoidant dynamic in which I was having extreme anxious preoccupied responses, and my partner was super avoidant and was like not meeting my emotional needs, and neither of us had any literacy about this, right? So we didn't understand what was going on. And for anyone who understands the anxious preoccupied attachment style, it's extremely flooding, right? It's very, very flooding. And your nervous system is constantly feeling like you're in a state of emergency and like you're going to die. And that combined with my very intense, complex PTSD meant that I was always in this extreme state of distress. And yet I also felt like I needed this relationship and I couldn't lose it no matter what, you know? And so I stayed in it for years, even though I was deeply unhappy. And all of my attempts to sort of try to address the unhappiness in the relationship were met with classic dismissal from my avoidant partner, who just was avoiding the situation and didn't really want to deal with it and didn't really know how to deal with it, right? But there was no coercive control. There was no name calling. There was no degradation. There was no humiliation. There was no sexual abuse. There was no physical abuse. There was just a really unhappy relationship that my needs were not being met, that I experienced as extremely emotionally dysregulating, right? Mm-hmm. Eventually, I decided to leave this relationship And doing so was absolutely devastating. And I felt like completely undone. Like I was going to therapy twice a week. I was like crying all the time. I was just completely debilitated by how much pain I was in. And whenever I would see my partner, like around my ex-partner around the city, I would have like a panic attack. I would immediately, my heart rate would go through the roof. I would feel like I was going to throw up. And then I would be like super depressed for the rest of the day.
Right? And where were you in your recovery, your sober recovery? Like how long have you been sober?
Maybe like, I guess I started the relationship when I was 2 years sober. So I would have been like almost 5 years sober by the time this ended. But like being a person who was still fucking poor and didn't have money, the therapy that I was able to access at that time was not exactly appropriate for the complex PTSD and developmental trauma that I had, right? So I was going to therapy and I was going to AA, but like I had really severe trauma that was not actually adequately being addressed through like the poor people therapy that I was able to access at that stage of my life, you know?
Totally.
And so, yeah, I still had a long way to go. And like complex PTSD is fucking hard to recover from, you know? So I was really dysregulated. And so I was inside this social justice culture that's very cancel-y and that always like moves towards this narrative of abuse, right? And so a well-meaning friend talking to me about it was like, your emotions are evidence of abuse. She literally said that. And she was like, this is an emotionally abusive relationship. That's why you're responding this way. And I was like, huh, you know, because first of all, when I thought about it like that, it was extremely regulating because I went from feeling super powerless and panicked and out of control to feeling angry. And that anger was grounding. Like that anger made me feel like I had some power and some control and a narrative that made sense. But I do remember questioning it because I was like, look, this relationship, yes, I was insanely unhappy, but it was nothing like my relationship when I was 23, you know, where my partner frequently like called me a disgusting slut and like physically abused me, you know? So I was like, this is obviously not that. But I was like, well, it seems like people are saying that abuse looks lots of different ways. And so maybe this is abuse. You know, I was extremely unhappy and, you know, my needs weren't being met. And why am I responding this way if it's not abuse? And so I believed that it was. I took that narrative on and I was like, abuse can look many different ways. And this must be a certain kind of emotionally abusive relationship. And so I started to tell people that. And I went through a couple years in which, fortunately, I did not do a giant public cancellation campaign because I already had some sense of like that feeling wrong to me. Like in my own journey, I was aware that like I wasn't really into the calling out thing.
Okay.
But I still was in a, I was sort of soft canceling my ex.
Right.
Because you like wrote about it and stuff.
I wrote about it, but I never named them.
Yeah.
I never named them, but like anyone who knew would know. And also I told people, and so it was going through the grapevine and it was probably affecting my ex for sure, you know? And so anyway, a couple years later, I was in therapy and I got a new therapist who's still my therapist to this day. And she's great. And so she had a sliding scale and I managed to get an actual trauma competent therapist for cheap. And so, you know, she knew my background. She knew my history. She knew about this relationship. And at a certain point, I described it as emotionally abusive. And she said, that was an unhappy relationship, not an abusive one. And as a survivor, it is extremely important for you to be able to discern the difference. And so the thing is that under cancel culture, my therapist could be canceled for this. Literally, I could have gone on the internet and been like, my therapist, you know, and so actually many therapists, because we talk to therapists, you know, about cancel culture, and many therapists are living in fear of actually being honest with their clients because they're actually afraid of being canceled, you know? So props to my therapist because she did an appropriate trauma intervention there. She wasn't saying, you know, because like many types of abuse that I've experienced have been subtle, you know, but they, you can still discern the difference. There's ways, it's not an unknowable thing. So when you talk about it, there's ways of discerning. Is this humiliating? Is this degrading? Is this controlling? You know,
is there a pattern?
Yeah. Like what is this? And, or is this a, because there was a pattern in this relationship too, but it was a pattern of an anxious, preoccupied, avoidant cycle of, you know, bids for attention and failure to meet those bids, which is an unhappy relationship. Like it did suck, you know, but the thing is that if I didn't have CPTSD and if I was more, like grounded and had more, more sense of like who I was and safety in the world, I would have left that relationship. Like I would have been like, this relationship isn't meeting my needs and I can leave it because there was nothing to keep me there. Like, except for the fact that I thought I would die if I left, but why did I think that, you know? And so anyway, like it was difficult at first for me to hear that, but I trusted her because she did not invalidate any of the abusive experiences in my life with like my parents or my childhood or my other things I've been through. She was like, those are abusive. This is not. And so I was able to hear that. And I was like, okay, let me think about this. And I came to understand that she was right. And so, you know, in the time since, I have made amends to my ex for slandering them, which they did take quite graciously. And also, like, I have part of my amends in a living amends sense is being honest about this and talking about it publicly that I did this and that this is something that I think actually happens more than we're willing to admit.
Hmm. So I like to try and leave people with something that they can do or something hopeful. What should people do when they see an online call out happening? Like, what in your best case scenario, like, what should people do when it comes up in their feed?
Well, I mean, I think that if you disagree with that kind of thing, you have the right to say so. And I think that it's good, actually, for people to just like simply be like, I don't agree with this kind of thing and I don't participate in it. You know, if you're being asked to participate in it, you can say no. It's scary, though.
I feel like there's so much fear.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
From people, though, to they're more afraid of like saying the wrong thing than doing the wrong thing. You know?
Yeah, it is really scary. There's no doubt about it, you know. But sometimes like doing the right thing is scary.
And I think that, you know, I would invite listeners to be curious about that fear, right? Because that fear is evidence that cancel culture is a real thing. Like, if we were only canceling the bad guys, why is someone feeling fear about making a comment on social media? Does that make you an abuser? Does that make you a terrible, dangerous person? Why is it so scary to do something like that? Why are you so afraid of stepping out of line? Because we do know that cancel culture is absolutely not just directed at abusers. Mm. In fact, most of the people who are canceled are not abusers. That I believe is true because I talk to fucking hundreds of canceled people, you know? And I think that, you know, the fact that we're afraid to stand up for something, even to make a comment that's like, hey, like, I understand that you guys are trying to like address something here, but like, you know, the person on the receiving end of this is still a human being and I'm worried about them. Like, even that can get you into a lot of fucking trouble. People can start coming for you, right? And so that is very concerning because the impact that it has on everyone, not just people who are canceled, but cancel culture is affecting everyone because it is making us fucking hypervigilantly afraid of thinking critically, being honest, like doing things that feel in integrity because we are so afraid of getting marked and getting called out and possibly getting canceled, you know? And so, you know, like the thing is that I think that it's important in this conversation that we spent a bunch of time talking about situations of serious abuse and trauma and like trying to discern this. But the reality is that many, many cancellations have nothing to do with any of the stuff that we were just talking about. And we need to be honest about that. A huge number of cancellations are because someone is accused of not posting about something political that they were supposed to have posted about, or that they expressed a political opinion, even a political opinion that is firmly on the left, but that was not following some sort of weird rule. We're immediately like, okay, that person's a fascist, you know? Like the way that we jump to extreme accusations when what is really going on is political disagreement, like minor conflict, interpersonal drama.
Yeah. And again, it's like, you know, actually it goes back to one of your questions earlier where you were sort of like, who are you to talk about this? And it's like,
I really didn't know to say it that didn't sound sassy.
No.
I'm sorry.
No,
I tried my best.
I get it. But like part of this is that we have a podcast about it and therefore people talk to us, you know?
Yeah.
And like literally, as Clinton said, like hundreds or at this point, like probably like 1,000 people have talked to us about their experiences, and we get like tons of messages and emails all the time. And so we have like a huge like backlog of like case studies to go by, you know what I mean? And we like meet people at our events and like, nah. And so we can discern a pattern, you know? And the pattern is that like, yeah, the huge majority of these people are like young, queer, like
yes,
non-binary, like kids who like
said
something on the internet that like some cruel like frenemy of theirs like had a problem with, and then they had their shit completely fucking destroyed, and now they are like in a room by themselves like banging their head against the wall, you know? And like it's really, 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 really awful. And people imagine that it's all these like super scary bad guys in plaid shirts who, you know, who did something really awful and are just experiencing consequences. But like for the most part, it's like nothing even remotely like that,
yeah,
you know? And like, so if you see if you see this kind of shit going on, I think that it's really important to just say, like, I don't like this. I think that it's, like, cruel and useless, you know? And it's also good to reach out to people who are experiencing this kind of thing and let them know that you don't like it either. Because a huge part of this, a huge part of why cancel culture, like, even works is that it successfully creates this atmosphere where, like, nobody can sort of, like, say anything about it, you know? You can sort of, like, pop that bubble by just, you know, speaking up in a calm manner and just being like, this is, like, fucking so stupid.
Yeah. Like, the Venn diagram of, like, cancel culture and abuse is a Venn diagram with actually minimal overlap. And the vast majority of people who are abusers are not canceled and I will never be canceled because they're not friends with, like, a bunch of hipsters who are canceling people on the internet. Sorry. Like, like the world that I was in when I was being abused was full of, like, my boyfriend was, like, in and out of jail. Like, the people that I was hanging out with were, like, smoking crack. So, like, those types of people are not canceling people on the internet. And a large number of people who are being abused are living in poverty and are living in, you know, social worlds that will never meet our online social justice world. And so pretending that cancel culture is helping those people at all is an absolute fantasy. The majority of abusers will never go anywhere near cancel culture. And then the majority of cancellations are not about abuse. The majority of cancellations are about a whole bunch of other stuff, interpersonal drama, like conflicts, political disagreements, or just simply, like, literally people
use unprocessed shit.
Yeah. And people use cancel culture to take down, like, what they perceive as their competition in our insane capitalist world, where tons of people are trying to make a living doing some kind of, like, online, like, content creation, like, creative job. You know, like, when I was canceled, you know, when I hit 10K followers on Instagram, I started having regular panic attacks because I knew it was coming. By the time I hit 50K, it came. And I was canceled for the most absurd nonsense in the entire world. Like, I was literally canceled for no fucking reason. You know, I was accused of not sharing about Black Lives Matter. Publicly in a call out post, I messaged the person. I was like, hey, I'm not sure why you're saying that because I have been sharing about it. You can see it on my page. And then I was demanded to deplatform. And when I just didn't reply to that message, I was called a white supremacist on a national, like, an international scale. And I lost all my friends and my housing, you know? And so pretending that has anything to do with abuse prevention or has anything to do with politics or has anything to do with anything
consequences
is absolutely absurd. You know, like, I had a very, very insane cancellation and it was for no fucking reason. And so there's a lot of cancellations that are like that. And the problem is that when people heard my cancellation, they didn't hear my side of it. They heard, right, Clementine has been called out for racism and she is not taking accountability. So when you hear that, it sounds bad. And so people who are like, well, I oppose racism, I obviously want to take this seriously. But if you actually hear the content of the accusation, which is that I was accused of not sharing about Black Lives Matter, and then when it was pointed out that I had shared about it, I was demanded to deplatform. That sounds a lot more absurd, but that's not the message that's being passed around on the internet, right? And so, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people are really, really scared to even think about this. Like, it immediately sends them into a nervous system dysregulation thing because they are thinking the unthinkable thoughts. They are thinking, and part of me is like, guys, why are there unthinkable thoughts? Are you in a fundamentalist religion? Is this a cult? Yeah. Because I'm like, you should be able to think freely about things. You should be able to speak freely about things. You should be able to ask questions. And if you are so afraid to think freely and ask questions because you are afraid that you're going to receive huge social consequences, that is evidence that cancel culture is absolutely real. And it is also evidence that you're living in a dysfunctional social world where you are expected to, like, submit and not think for yourself. So unfortunately, the only way out is out, right? And, like, the only way you're going to find people who think that it's okay for you to think for yourself is to start thinking for yourself. And you will start to receive consequences. Like, if you're deep in that social world, you will lose friends. People will talk shit about you. But you will find the people who actually share the similar values and principles that you have, where you believe that people should be able to think about things and talk about things. And so that will feel a lot better, you know? Like, the process out of that world into a social world that encourages, you know, just
your autonomy.
Yeah. And your right to think for yourself is, like, it can be painful, but it's so much better on the other side.
Tell people where to find you.
You can check out our podcast at fuckingcancel.com with two L's because we're Canadian. And it's also on, like, all the regular places you find podcasts, you know. Clementine's website is clementinemorgan.com. Mine is jlasole.com. We both write on our websites and you can catch our writing there. We're also both on Instagram with those names, Clementine Morgan, jlasole.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah. Thank you for having us. Thanks for your courage and being willing to have this conversation.
Yeah, hell yeah.
I do think I might get canceled for having you on the show, which made me think, well, then I should probably do it to get over that fear. You know, that's real.
Yeah, totally.
Thank you.
Thanks to Clementine and Jay for their time. I actually had 16 other questions that we didn't even get close to answering, so apologies to any followers who submitted a question that didn't get answered. Maybe if there's a demand for it, we can do a follow-up with them, so let me know if you'd like to hear that. You can support this podcast by liking my YouTube channel and sharing, subscribing, and reviewing But Her Lyrics wherever you get your podcasts. It's free, and it does help. To find episode transcripts or find out more about what I do, my book, my trainings, my Patreon, my intimacy coordination, head to shaunapotter.com. To learn about all things war on women, head to our link tree at linktr.ee/war on women. And you can also find me on Cameo. I don't know if you know that. I've been asked to give wonderful birthday messages, advice, even what my favorite Star Trek episodes are. But sorry, no spoilers. If you'd like to know, ask me on Cameo. The next episode of But Her Lyrics will feature some awesome punk music. And on Patreon, you can check out my bonus episode with Sky Daddy right now. And soon, a diary about getting arrested in DC. Until next time.